So thinking back about how my practice started, it's probably similar, if not the same, as just about everybody who comes to practice, which is that it has something to do with suffering. I would not have thought of myself as suffering then. That would not have been my reason. I probably would have said, "Oh, I'm just curious about meditation." But when I look back, I see how deeply I was suffering at that particular time of my life, as well as just in general, and being really clueless about it. And because I was clueless, of course, causing a lot of other people to suffer as well. But what got me to stay was that the very first Dharma talk that I heard was about compassion. And there I was already grown up and with children of my own, and I don't think I had ever really, I mean, I knew the word, but I don't think I'd ever heard it used. And I certainly had no conception of this idea of having compassion for myself. That was very far from any experience that I had ever had or even thought about, and certainly not one which I thought I deserved, as if there is such a thing. But I did not think so. But that really drew me in, and I think while I'm a very eclectic practitioner in a lot of ways, I go from one thing to another to another. I think really at root, compassion and loving kindness are really what it's about. So I wanted to talk about compassion this morning and maybe also do a couple of experiential things because I like to do it. I like to do have experiences. So part of what is firing me up right now is that I went to hear a talk by Joan Halifax recently. I don't know if any of you know her and her work, but she works with the dying and compassionate care. And she recently gave a talk at Stanford. She was interviewed. And what was really interesting to me was that it's often said that compassion cannot be taught. And empathy cannot be taught. I work with children. I work with adults, but I've also worked with children my whole life. And one of the things that I've worked with parents about is the capacity for empathy. But you can't really sit a child down or an adult down and say, "Look, here's how you be empathic. Here's how you learn compassion." It's not teachable. And yet, what Joan Halifax said was, because compassion is like everything else in the universe, it's codependent. Everything, you know, it doesn't exist on its own, but it is made up of non-compassion elements. And those elements can be taught. So these are the things that make it, that prime you for feeling compassion. And she sort of has three different, what she calls axes. So it's a three-dimensional model, which is also quite attractive to me. So it's three-dimensional. And the three parts briefly are attention and affect regulation, and intention and insight, and embodiment and enactment. Now, attention, we all did this morning. We practice zazen. We do a lot of that. There's probably other practices that you might do that require attention. Oh, and by the way, these three different aspects are not themselves independent, and they don't. It's very difficult in some ways to talk about them one at a time because they are so interdependent. They're so interwoven. So I'll be slipping and sliding among them. But attention, also what's important is affect regulation. And it really surprises me sometimes, particularly with children, how few words young children will have for emotions. And there's something that's very powerful. Maybe you know this in your Zazen practice. When you can name something, it loses its hold over you. You know, it's like the story of the Buddha when he's about to be enlightened, and he says, you know, jailer, you no longer have a hold on me. That's because he understood the nature of suffering, and he could name it. And when we can name our experience, we can say, oh, this is anger. Already anger has changed. Or, oh, this is joy. Maybe joy has deepened by naming it. So, and then intention and insight, he says these are cognitive qualities. I mean, Joan Halifax says these are cognitive qualities. And we've also done that this morning, I think, by reciting the rope chant. These are our vows. This is our intention. Whether you actually have one of these pieces of sewn cloth or not, you put on that mind robe when you say that chant. You do have that intention of saving all beings. And that, as she said, as she's saying about all of these, they make us more ready to be compassionate. And then finally, the third thing is embodiment. And frankly, I think that this is an area that Zen practice could do better. Because while we say our practice is embodied and we pay attention to posture, often we are not very friendly to our bodies. And if you sit a long sesshin and you really take literally, I just sat sesshin here last month, had I taken that schedule literally in my body at my age, I would have been in a lot of trouble. So I think it's difficult to understand what we say in Zen. We say follow the schedule completely, but that's not the same as following the schedule literally. And but we also, there are other practices that we can do that I think are really important for engendering and priming us, as Halifax says, for compassion. So the reason these are important to do, for instance, what I said before about affect regulation, knowing where a feeling is in our body, and having some experience of our bodily physiological processes as they're connected to our affect. What they found is that when they work with people, you know, all these tests that they can do now of hooking you up to fMRIs or whatever, but when you are engaged with paying attention to your inner physiological processes, the same area of the brain lights up as when you are feeling empathic for somebody else. Isn't that interesting? That when we tune in to our own process, we are priming ourselves and readying ourselves and open to the same thing as when someone across the room from us is having a feeling, especially one that we can sort of notice. Those of you, it just strikes me, those of us who have children know that when your child is feeling distress, you feel that distress. It's one of the, you know, in the sutra that we chanted, even as a mother, doesn't even have to be the risk of her life to protect her only child. It just is very natural. You know, I have a child who is 3,000 miles away who's going through difficulty, and my heartstrings are out there towards him. I can't help it. So on the theme of embodiment, though, I wonder right now if you might sort of tune into where your body is in space and how it feels in this moment, sitting on a cushion, sitting on a chair, maybe just going inward for a moment and noticing any places of comfort, places of tension, just sort of do a check-in on your body. Where is your body? Can you know your body right now in this moment? And as I say, noticing any physical sensations. What's asking for your attention? And then maybe noting any emotion that you may be carrying. And where does that locate itself? And then, as I say, just noticing the contact with the floor, with your knees or your feet or your behind. Where is there strength and where is there relaxation? So, having done that, I wonder if anyone, it's a very short time, we could spend half an hour doing that. And actually, I think that a lot of the mindfulness practices, practicing with the four foundations of mindfulness, is really helpful to deepen our feelings of compassion, as well as just getting to know our bodies. So, did anything arise for anyone just in that very short time of tuning in? Or you're already all tuned in? Yeah.
For me, I'm Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for saying your name again.
I noticed a really feeling and sensation of joy in my belly, mm-hmm. and then rising all the way up mm-hmm. and spreading through my body, just kind of a lightness and a tingling, because what you're speaking about is just so resonating with me.
So I already primed you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, anybody else have any sensation or, and you don't have to share it, just to know for yourself, was there something that occurred that was new to you, or at least news of this morning to you? Yeah.
Yes, I noticed immediately when you asked that I was in my head and not living in this part of my body so much, and I found that as soon as I looked outside, it helped me to think.
Yes.
And I realized I was holding my diaphragm because I was focusing so hard on your words up here in my head. So I just found myself kind of like
this tension here.
Yeah. It's almost like I was trying to figure all these things out mentally, and as soon as I was able to kind of, you know, breathe into my whole body, everything eased and balanced out.
And how often do we do that? You know, I just I spent 8 weeks teaching a mindfulness stress reduction class, mostly to Zen people from our group. And one person in the group said he hadn't realized before he started the class that every time he sat down in front of the computer, he was holding his breath. And this is a man who spends a lot of his time in front of his computer. So he was holding his breath a lot. And it really made a difference to exhale. Yeah. Well, thank you. That, by the way, is a very helpful practice for attention. A little bit what you were saying is to pay attention to the exhale. Not so much the inhalation, because we tend to, you know, when our mothers taught us to take a deep breath, often we would and hold it and really It's exhale. I just taught a little boy this a few weeks ago. I was trying to help him with his anger. And I said, you need to exhale. And he didn't quite get what the word was. And finally, at the end of our session, he said, oh, you mean outhale. Yeah, that works. Yes, outhale. See how long you can outhale. Because it really does reduce that holding that we do. So anybody else want to share anything? Yeah.
I actually have a question. I'm John.
Hi, John.
So what's the difference, again, in embodiment and the regulation?
Affect regulation. Well,
I know you said these really cross over.
For me, they cross over because any affect that you have, it's in your body. We think it's in our head. Oh, I feel sad. But actually, studies have shown that in the split second before, and it is less than a second before you have a thought of a feeling, your body has already registered it. So the body registers it first, then we give a name to it. So it's very difficult to tease out what is embodiment, what is affect. Affect is embodied. But by embodiment, I guess I'm specifically talking about practices that focus on the body, like being attentive to what the sensations are in the body, being attentive, as the four foundations say, attentive to the feelings in the feelings and the body in the body, not how we're thinking about them, but how they're actually arising. So yoga is another, that's an embodied mindfulness practice. You know, which I engage in, and I think more and more at Zen centers they're offering that during retreats. So that's another example of an embodied practice, something that uses the body. I mean, and Zazen is embodied. This is a body that we're using for this practice, but we aren't always kind to it. So one of the things, I was listening on the way here to a talk by Leslie James at Tassajara, and she was talking about knowing your body. She said, you know, for us to know our mind is kind of that's a difficult proposition because our mind, first of all, is all over the place, and we know the self. The self we know is not inherently real, but the body, you know, can we know where our body is right now in space and time? And sometimes we don't really, we aren't in our bodies, even when we've been sitting long sesshin or even just one period of, we're all up here. So to know where our body is really helps us connect to other bodies. I mean, we aren't disconnected. And yet when we tune in, and I think that was the meaning that long ago evening of the Dharma talk of really having compassion for yourself. Because until we tune into ourselves and have compassion here, there's no way for it to go out there. So I just want to say a couple of other things. Well, one is that we can get very caught up in, and I do, get caught up in like the newest practice and the newest technique and all of those things that come along that we want to try. And so I got very excited about Joan Halifax's model because it, first of all, it affirms that what we're doing is compassion training, and that I like to think that that's what we're doing. But we also have to be careful not to reify it, not to get too caught up or excited in it, because it's nothing special. So Norman Fisher has recently written a book about the Lojong practices, and he calls it training in compassion. But he says something at the very end, which you know is a good reminder to me, as I'm very excited about ways to prime myself and others towards compassion. He says, whatever you privilege, whatever you define and adhere to, is always wrong and will, because wrong, always lead to a problem and a danger. whether it is meditation or compassion or goodness or truth or enlightenment. Whatever noble thing you'd want to know, experience, or aspire to, as soon as you privilege it and make a big deal out of it, there's always trouble. Compassion, for instance, sounds like such a good idea, but the problem with it is that it will probably make us sentimental, soft-headed, and overly enthusiastic. And this will tend to make us troublesome to exactly the people we want to have compassion for. Because our excessive sentimentality and insistence on being helpful will probably be annoying and counterproductive. So, this, of course, is the opposite of compassion. Asked about what compassion really is, an old Zen master said, "It is like reaching back through your pillow in the dark." In other words, it's a simple and natural human act, no big deal. So while I'm, you know, passionate about compassion, it's important to remember it's really no big deal, and that my passion for it, our passion for it, our practice really can be the very thing that we trip over. So anyway, that's what I have to say. I'm interested whether any of you have any questions or comments you would like to offer.
Last week, Doug said something about the root of compassion being passion. Do you have any more to say on that?
Then calm is before the passion. I don't at this time, Cliff. But I got a dilemma.
Okay.
And that is, we need to practice compassion, of course. But then in our midst are public officials that have participated in war crimes that are still free. So what do we do? How do we... Where's the compassion? What role does compassion have in perhaps continuing the set of circumstances that may result in some these guys getting some epiphany?
So you would like them to change their ways, understand...
You gave a good start, you know, with the three components of compassion. And
so what would help them? Is that what you're asking? Yeah. So, boy, a lot of things run through my mind. One is that many years ago, there was a woman who practiced with us who is now in her 80s. So she doesn't come so often. We see her maybe once every year or two. One of the, you know, most compassionate people that I know. And back, well, I guess it was during the first Gulf War, maybe it was then, she was listening to the radio, and she told us this story, and the radio, there was all the story about war and fighting, and she was just so angry about it, and she snapped at her husband, "Turn that thing off!" And then she realized that the anger and the war was right there in her heart. And as I say, she is one of the, I just don't see an angry bone in her body, but she felt it. We all have it. So the first place is here. You know, how do we, first of all, have compassion for those people who do make war and commit war crimes? There is great suffering there. They may not be experiencing it, but it's there. So first of all, for ourselves, but then for them. But then finally, the hopeful thing that goes through my mind is there is a man now in Congress. Did any of you know? I think he's from, he's either Ohio or Iowa.
Ohio.
Do you remember his name?
Tim Ryan.
Tim Ryan. And he took a mindfulness-based stress reduction class, and he was just, oh my God, all the doors opened, and he is really promoting this. And he was at the Wisdom 2.0 conference, and he goes back to Congress, and so he is bringing the practice there. So the final thing, oh, it's not in this book. There's another commentary by Pema Chodron, and two more by Trungpa on the same teachings of Lojong. And at the very end, so these teachings go back to the 10th century to Atisha. At the very end, there's some sort of dedication about being able to practice this. I don't have it exactly right, but something about during the five dark times. And I'm thinking, okay, 10th century, dark, dark times. When has it not been like this? So, just sends me back to sitting and compassion here. But, you know, some people take it out into the world much more forcefully, like Tim Ryan. And if that's where you're moved, I would say the best thing is to get people to sit down and practice. Yeah. It's a tough question. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So let's, if I may, I'd like to go back to, we use a lot of words, so I think it's refreshing to examine what the word means. So let's, if you would, you know, share with us what
compassion means.
Compassion,
yeah.
So
compassion literally means to suffer with. Comes from the Latin to suffer. So it's to suffer with, to feel the suffering of another. And I've been thinking about this a lot, so thank you for asking. There's a difference between that and empathy, because empathy is just taking in and being able to feel what you feel. But compassion includes, on top of that, the understanding of suffering, the understanding of the root of suffering, the cause of suffering, my suffering. It's just with that understanding, which is really all important, because it takes it to another level. It takes it out of self and other. You know, we're together in that. And the way Joan Halifax defined it, she had a really good definition. I really liked it. Let's see. She says, it's an emergent process. So it's something that just arises. It's an emergent process in a dynamic, adaptive relationship between mind, body, and the environment. So, and it's adaptive. I love that. So it's something that we really need. You know, back to your question, Doug, you know, we may never solve all the problems of war and crimes, but we continue to go down in that direction. We have to head in that direction. And that's adaptive, both individually and, you know, for our society. So mind, body, and the environment, which also means self and other, because, of course, in the environment are all the others.
But if I may, one thing, does it imply that there's an alleviation of suffering with the other?
Maybe.
I mean, it depends on...
It's being with the suffering. So the suffering, I think that suffering, I don't think that suffering really ends so much as it's transformed. So we transform it into maybe some action that we want to take, or we transform it into a hug. We transform it, you know, I don't think there's ever an end to suffering, but we can work with it and meet it, and in a sense that is where it ends, by meeting it and being fully present.
You went quickly in the definition through the root of suffering and the root of compassion. Could you say a little bit more about the roots?
Well, I'm just thinking of the Four Noble Truths, you know. So the second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is our clinging and our aversion, holding on to, you know, what we don't want to let go of, and turning away from what we don't like, you know. So holding on to our, well, I don't know, our possessions or our joys, and pushing the other things away that we don't want to have. Oh, I don't like that pain in my knee. I had that experience just this morning. I do have a pain in my knee. And funny thing, it was really sort of here and there during the first sitting, and the second, and I'm just watching it. Okay, I'm trying not to be too bothered by the second sitting, and even now it's kind of subsided. I decided on the way up here it's related to driving the car. So anyway, but it comes and goes. So was that?
Thank you.
Yeah. So when? How long do we have? Are we done? Okay. Any other questions from anyone? Yeah.
Well, then, what's curious is the second noble truth is the clinging to suffering. It seems it seems very illogical to, let's say it's emotional suffering. Because when it's a body pain, it's a little different. I mean, it's suffering, it's suffering, but if something is pulsating with pain, that's different. But past hurts, emotional distress, these things—it's a curious sort of thing, isn't it? Well, what, there's this term, just let it go. I mean, it's just kind of just let it, just forget about it.
Yeah, and actually, I don't.
So where are you with this?
I am not with letting it go. I'm a child of the '60s, so I'm with letting it be. Because I don't think we ever really do let things go, except to have them arise again. Mm-hmm. And letting things be is much more doable. I always felt like I was a failure when I would be told to let it go, because I wasn't letting it go. But we can let things be. Again, we can be with them and be present. And I don't think it's actually any different than the pain in my leg. That if we can just be present to it and pay attention to it, not giving it all of our attention, because if we give a hurt all of our attention, it gets bigger. But if we give it attention, and we also give attention to other people in the room and other things that have happened and the sky and the sunlight outside, we expand our awareness, then letting it be gets much easier. But I think you are exactly right. We do cling to suffering.
What's the payoff?
Isn't that funny? I mean, what I meant by the second noble truth is that we cling, not necessarily to suffering, but even suffering. I mean, have you not noticed that with people that you know, or even yourself, that you have something and you are not going to let it go? Or you're going to stay in a relationship and continue and perpetuate a relationship with someone that is icky, and you do it anyway.
So what's the payoff?
It's familiar.
Oh.
And the payoff is not good, but it is familiar. And it's work to let things be. It means I have to pay attention. And once you start to pay attention, I think it becomes very easy. You kind of can't not anymore. You can't not pay attention. Once you've started, it's what I've heard people call the curse of awareness. So once you become aware that there is suffering, as I said, the first time I came to practice, I did not know how deep my suffering was. Once I became aware of it, yeah, it was really painful for a few years. But then there was no way I could not pay attention to it, and I could not start to try to relinquish some of it. You know, you can't turn back. Bad news. It's too late. So, I mean, it's a good place to stop. It's too late.